Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today, as usual, is my wonderful mom, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. Another beautiful day here in Iowa.
And it's a beautiful fall day, and when we're recording this, and also when it will be airing, we're leading up into November, which there's a couple things we celebrate in November. One of them is, of course, Thanksgiving, and the other one is Veterans Day. And that's apropos to the book that we're talking about today.
Yes.
Mom, would you like to introduce our guest?
Well, yes, I would. It's the book is Wounds of War, and it's by Suzanne Gordon.
Suzanne Gordon is the co-editor of a Cornell University Press series on the culture and politics of healthcare work. She has written or co-authored many books, most recently The Battle for Veterans Healthcare and Beyond the Checklist. And this book, Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans, is really quite eye-opening. Suzanne's also an award-winning journalist. She's written for the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, goes on and on and on. And she's written 20 books and is co-editor of 8 other books, including one that I found, the title I found really interesting, When Chicken Soup Isn't Enough, Stories of Nurses Standing Up for Themselves, Their Patients, and Their Profession. And Suzanne is an assistant adjunct professor at the UCSF School of Nursing, I assume that's University of California, San Francisco, and an affiliated scholar with the University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine's Wilson Center. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Suzanne.
Thank you.
With all the writing you do, how do you have time to be a professor, too?
I do less professing than I do lecturing around the world. It's an appointment. It's almost more of an honorific than I teach. But I have taught nursing and medical schools, and I'm also affiliated with the University of Toronto School of Medicine.
So, are you a nurse yourself?
No, I'm a journalist, okay. And I've been writing about healthcare since about 1986, and I've been a journalist since 1970. So I mostly spent my early part of my career writing about women's issues and political culture, and then when I had my first child in a small community hospital outside of Boston, I began to understand the work nurses do and started writing about nursing, and that led me into writing about healthcare, which eventually led me to writing this book about the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest healthcare system in the country.
You know,
and it's also the the second largest branch of the federal government. So the Department of Veterans Affairs is the second largest branch of the federal government, mm-hmm. and the Department of Veterans Affairs has 3 agencies: the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest agency in the Department of Veterans Affairs; the Veterans Benefit Administration, which determines what benefits veterans get; and then the National Cemetery Administration, and that's burials and the nation's memorials and burial grounds. Uh-huh. So the VA, when it's kind of important to make the distinction, because particularly when you're talking to veterans, if they complain about the VA, they're often complaining about the Veterans Benefit Administration, not the Veterans Health Administration, although some do complain about the VHA.
Well, you know, this book was a real eye-opener for me, partially because, and you address this, how much negative press the VHA has gotten in recent years, and yet I was always puzzled because I don't know a lot of veterans who receive care from the VHA, but over the years, all the ones that I know thought they did a great job. They were very grateful for the care that they got there. And yet,
So,
you know, the press makes it sound like it's, you know, horrible and messed up, and it's really not.
yeah, well, the press, I mean, this is a big subject for me. I did an article with a colleague called Jasper Craven in the Washington Monthly called Unhealthy Skepticism about the Media and the VA, the VHA, and Jasper and I just did a longer report for the Veterans Health Policy Institute, which I'm a senior policy fellow at, and we did a longer piece on the media and the VA. And I mean, here's the problem: the VHA is the most, and I would almost say only, really transparent healthcare system in the country, and it has, you know, it's responsible to Congress. It's responsible to veteran service organizations. It has its own office of the inspector general looking at its problems and the things it does well. And so every little blip on the radar at the VHA is openly discussed. And so that means that the press, which loves to write about negative things, will take and really amplify out of proportion the problems that the VHA reveals to the public, which is a really good thing because you want to know about problems so you can fix them. How do we learn, Carol and Monica? We learn from our mistakes, right? And if you don't discuss those mistakes, then you can't learn. And in the private sector, which unfortunately few journalists really seem to consider, when there are mistakes or malpractice or whatever, they are often either covered up, or if there's a suit between a patient and a hospital or a doctor, there's often a non-disclosure agreement that's attached to any settlement. And this has become a big subject of controversy in medicine, these non-disclosure agreements, because the patient can't talk to medical boards or public health boards or whatever, and that means you can't learn anything from these mistakes because you don't know about them. And the VHA has a completely different model, and it is rewarded for its openness by this sort of punitive, blaming, shaming attitude, which those of us who work in patient safety know, or education know, is a really poor attitude to adopt for people who make mistakes, because people, if you shame people or blame people or sort of criminalize mistakes, they go underground and you can't learn from them. And the evidence of our failure to learn from our mistakes is that the American private sector, American healthcare system, kills between, I would say, 300,000, 400,000 people every year from preventable medical errors.
Wow. And, oh, my gosh.
So, you know, they talk about problems in the VA, but they're really dwarfed by the problems in the private sector. And it's very discouraging. I mean, one of the reasons I was so excited to write about the VHA is that I'd written for so long about patient safety and teamwork in private sector healthcare, and we weren't getting anywhere. I mean, we have really, you know, in 1999, the Institute of Medicine did a report that said that we killed 98,000 people every year in private sector healthcare from preventable medical errors. It's now 2018, and the only way we've advanced is that we know now that we kill not 98,000, but up to 400,000. And that's not, you know, so I'm
that's
just
not the
so
kind
excited.
Of progress you're looking for.
No. And so I was really excited when I started writing about the VHA and saw that, wow, they really take patient safety and teamwork seriously. I mean, I've been trying to convince American hospitals to follow the example of the aviation industry, the commercial aviation industry, which in the late, in the early 1980s, started to take crashes and problems very seriously and instituted very serious and rigorous team training. And the safety record is now really just amazingly good. when and before it was amazingly bad, and hospitals are just like completely resistant to this idea. And then I stumbled on teamwork training at the VHA, and that was like so serious and rigorous, and it's really a remarkable system. And it's very sad to me that people like yourselves, who are knowledgeable people, are surprised at my book. But then I'm not surprised that you're surprised, because
I always felt there was a disconnect between what I was seeing in the press and what I was hearing from personal experience. But even to bring it down to kind of a very simple level that everyone can understand, there's criticism, for example, about how long it takes a veteran to get an appointment, because that's all tracked and that publicity, that data is available. In the private sector, nobody knows how long it takes people to get an appointment, because who's trying to figure it out? You know, who's tracking that across these multitudes of providers?
There's no, that's not a quality measure. I mean, And the issue of wait times has been largely addressed in the VHA. I mean, there's still a problem because, and we can get to this, I hope, later in the discussion, but there's still a problem because there's not enough staff and Congress is not giving them the money, and the president refuses to give them the money to hire enough staff. But the wait time problem is really been remedied, but the wait time problem in the private sector, which is appalling, you talk about wait times. In primary care providers in the private sector, there's often no wait times because there's not enough primary care providers, so people's practices are closed to new patients. Mm. And then there's this new movement towards concierge care where, you know, they say if you want the kind of care that a veteran gets at the VA, with the kind of individualized attention that they get for nothing in the VHA, you have to pay $7,000 a year for your concierge doctor, who then has to shed patients to get his patient panel down from 2,100 to 300 to 500. And so you then have, you know, not only your practice is closed, but I experienced this myself. You know, your primary care doctor just goes out of business and doesn't even tell you. So these kinds of things. You know, the headlines are trumpeting the bad things about the VHA, not the amazing good things. And then they're not asking the question, compared to what? Because the assumption in America is government can do no right and the private sector can do no wrong, and that is just not true in healthcare.
It's not true in any industry, and I'm an entrepreneur, a business person, and I know the mistakes that get made in private industry. There's no perfection. Everyone, it's people running companies and people working in government agencies. It's all people. It all comes down to human beings.
Absolutely. And you know, I think that one of the things I try to do in my book, and hopefully I've succeeded, is to focus on the amazing care and the innovations in care that the VHA has pioneered that I think we should all get the benefit from. And we do get the benefit from VHA research. I mean, most people don't know that the VHA is the biggest research powerhouse in the country. And, you know, thank you, VA, for my shingles vaccine. And I don't smoke, but if I did, I'd use the nicotine patch, which they pioneered. And, you know, just countless research innovations that they've pioneered. The VHA teaches 70% of American physicians, tons of psychologists, nurses, social workers, physical therapists, occupational therapists, you name it, they go through the VA. And the innovations in clinical care that the VA sadly doesn't get credit for in the media are really stunning and really the focus of my book. I mean, how they treat, how they deliver primary care, how they integrate mental health care and primary care, how they treat PTSD and post-traumatic stress disorder and prevent suicide. And, wow, I mean, I was stunned by the geriatric care and the end-of-life care that they deliver. And then you have these programs that nobody knows about, like to reduce veteran homelessness. So the VHA is way more than a medical treatment system. It's a real whole health system.
You actually say in the introduction that the VHA has four major missions that you kind of talked about, and delivering patient care is the primary one, but there's the others, the research and the teaching and the and emergency preparedness are others. On the teaching one, you have a statistics in here that the VHA trains 70% of the nation's medical residents. How is that possible?
Because it's the largest healthcare system in the country, and it has academic affiliations with many huge teaching institutions, academic medical centers. So, for example, in San Francisco, the San Francisco VA healthcare system is connected to UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, and Palo Alto is connected to Stanford, and Boston is connected to Boston University, et cetera, et cetera. And so if the VA were privatized, the medical education and training system in the U.S. would collapse because they take so many residents, but not just medical students. I mean, psychologists do internships and you know, we'll do a year of their training in the VA, at the VHA. The same is true of nurses and so forth. So, and what's very interesting is that while the VA will acknowledge the medical school partner, and you hear people say, oh, the VA is so good because it's connected to UCSF or Boston University, you almost never hear Boston University or UCSF say, we're so great because we're connected to the VA. So the VA is really like, you know, a woman attached to a guy in, you know, 1940 or something. And, you know, he takes credit for her work, and it's not a real partnership. And that's something that I find extremely irksome, and I wish that these academic medical centers would get their act together and acknowledge the partnership, because it's not a partnership if one partner says the other partner's great and the other partner pretends the other partner's invisible.
Yeah, really.
Why do they do that? Why do the academics do that?
Because they're not into partnership and collaboration. And why don't they teach teamwork to doctors and nurses? They don't. I mean, not really. And also, but I think that the other kind of teaching that we really need to focus on when we look at the VA, this is extremely unusual, is the way they teach people who already work there. You know, so for example, I have a section in my book about, I attended a training for 3 days. They have a national program to teach physicians and psychologists and social workers, anybody who really wants to sign on, who's working with patients, something called motivational interviewing. And this is like a critical skill that is not taught in medical schools and nursing schools and so forth. And it's essentially a way of motivating patients to stop smoking or drinking or eating or whatever it is, whatever behavior needs to be changed, as opposed to like reading them the Riot Act and telling them all the bad things that are going to happen to them if they don't stop smoking or eating or drinking. And it's really, really a useful skill. It's very complex. And the VHA, they teach people, they put them through a 3-day training, and then they give them 6 months of supervision where they have to record interviews and, you know, encounters with patients, and they get coached and helped in how to change their own behavior towards patients. And that's, you know, I mean, in private sector healthcare, you would never find that. You know, somebody might take a 2-hour course, but there'd be no supervision in PTSD, for example. And we know that up to 30% of veterans may have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. They teach people what's called evidence-based treatments, prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive processing therapy, and it's the same kind of thing. They do a training, and then they get 6 months or a year of supervision. They've taught thousands of providers how to do these trainings, and it's just, you know, remarkable. the attention that they pay to helping people learn how to be better clinicians. Because, you know, you go to medical school or nursing school or psychology school, and that was a long time ago, right? And new things come down the pike, and we have new insights and new treatments. And you have to learn how to do them. And learning how to do them isn't just reading a book or an article or watching a PowerPoint. It's being coached in how to do it the right way. You know, I don't know how many, I don't know if you've ever gone to a PT or a yoga class. You know, they teach you how to do a pose or how to do an exercise, and you think you got it, right? And then you go home and you're doing it all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And you have to go back, and they say, oops, you know, oh, no, you're going to hurt your knee that way, you know,
right.
This little adjustment. And that's the kind of thing that they do. I mean, one of the chapters in the book that I like the best is a small profile of a woman who's a neurologist. She's an epileptologist, which means she treats epilepsy. She runs the VA Centers of Excellence in Epilepsy, and I never knew this existed, but it turns out that there's something called psychogenic epilepsy, where people who've had horrible trauma, they have seizures when they sort of think of the trauma, and they look like epileptics. And 30% of epilepsy wards are filled with these people who don't have epilepsy, and they have a psychological problem. They are sent to a psychologist or psychiatrist or whatever, and they start talking about the, you know, the trauma, and then they seize. They have a seizure, and which looal like a, you know, grand mal epilepsy seizure. It's kind of scary, right? And the psychologist goes, oh, my God, I don't know how to deal with this, and sends them back to the epileptologist, and they get sent back and forth and don't get better. And then they discovered that if you use this wonderful therapy the VA does called cognitive behavioral therapy or processing therapy, you can cure or, you know, manage psychogenic epilepsy. So she learned how to do CBT from a guy in the VA who does it. And she spent like a year or more learning how to do this technique to treat this very complex, difficult to treat problem. And she said to me, I could never do this in the private sector. I have to leave my practice and have to become a psychologist, you know, 5 years, and then learn this treatment. And in the VA, they teach each other. And that's really, I mean, I'm not saying that couldn't happen in private sector healthcare. It probably wouldn't. Maybe there's some people where it could happen. But there's this community of learning in the VA when it's at its best that is really remarkable and that we should learn from throughout American medicine.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Suzanne Gordon, author of Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans. One of the things that struck me as I was looking through your book was how sort of progressive the VA is in terms of the treatments it offers, that it's we hear integrative medicine is kind of a buzzword, but it seems like, and you do talk about the VA as being at the forefront of being able to offer an integrative approach. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. I'm so glad you asked me that question, because there are so many levels on which the VHA offers integrated care. I mean, there's the level, there's the national level where, you know, a veteran from Boston can move to San Francisco and go to a VA facility and get care, and their electronic medical record follows them, as opposed to me moving from Boston to San Francisco. It took me 5 months to get my doctor to send my record, you know. That's one level. But the most important level is that care is integrated at the unit level. So in primary care, and this is one of the most stunning advances in the VHA, so a psychiatrist named Andrew Pomerantz in Vermont, White River Junction, Vermont, developed a model of integrated mental health and primary care. It took years for him to do this. And so basically, rather than you go to your doctor and you complain you're depressed or you're anxious or whatever, and your doctor writes you a referral to a mental health provider, and you have to call and make an appointment, and maybe you go, and more likely you don't. In this White River Junction model, which has gone national and is in everywhere in the VHA, you complain to your primary care doctor or nurse practitioner that you're feeling depressed, and they say, would you like to talk to a psychologist who's right down the hall, and let me take you down there and introduce you to this person right now, and they will talk to you, and then you will continue either seeing them or they may refer you to mental or behavioral health. So it's way more likely that you're going to follow through if your physician or nurse practitioner introduces you to the mental health provider. It sort of destigmatizes it. You discover that they're not going to spend 20 years with you on a couch talking about, you know, your father and mother and your sister and brother. And they found that there was way more success in getting people into substance abuse or mental health therapy, and that it was more satisfying for clinicians. The same is true of pharmacy. They have pharmacists on the unit. They have dietitians. So you're having trouble losing weight, they'll walk you down to the dietitian, and you can talk to that person about your problems and losing weight or taking your insulin or whatever. Then there's another level of integration or integrative care, which is for pain, where they have integrative pain teams, because veterans suffer from way more pain, chronic pain, than most of us because of, you know, carrying all these packs around, for 100-pound packs on your back for years on end, or, you know, having these terrible concussive injuries or amputations, or you name it, they've got it. And so they have integrated pain teams, and they're trying to really hard to wean people off opiates, which they never get any credit for. And, you know, they'll have a pain psychologist, an expert pain doctor. They'll go to pain classes. They'll go to yoga. They'll go to meditation. They'll get non-opioid pharmacological treatment. It's really impressive. And let me give you an example that I think is really stunning. I have a very good friend who has suffered from chronic back pain, and he is in the private sector. He's very good insurance, goes to some fancy schmancy orthopedic surgeon in a big hospital in San Francisco, and the guy looks at his x-rays and says, oh, you're not a candidate for surgery. You know, I see why you have pain. Well, you know, just live with it. You're going to just have to live with it. And, you know, maybe PT will be okay, and maybe acupuncture will help. He doesn't, you know, give him a referral. He doesn't give him any names. And he basically takes the money and runs. And I heard that story, and I thought, if this guy were a veteran, he'd be sent to a pain class, and we know pain classes reduce perceptions of pain significantly. He'd be sent to PT. He'd be sent to acupuncture, he'd be sent to yoga or meditation, and all of it would be coordinated. They'd talk to each other about him. And, you know, now he might not go, but chances are he would, and chances are he'd do a lot better. But in this case, you know, it's kind of, okay, what do I do now?
Yeah. Yeah, it just leaves them hanging in the air. You know, this thing about PTSD? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that doesn't just go away in one treatment, even in a few months. I know someone who has that, and they just it can't seem to get that healed, because that's something that's so, you know,
It's a tough one. Yeah, it's a tough issue.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, PTSD is a serious chronic condition. It can be significantly helped, but you have to go through evidence-based treatment. And they've discovered at the VA, for example, that some people who don't respond to treatment, they don't respond because they have additional problems because they've killed someone. And because not everybody who is in combat kills people. And so they've discovered that a lot of people who have killed people have extra problems, and they have a whole new way of treating these people who've killed people in combat, and that has significantly helped. But, you know, if you're treating a population of people, right, who have a specific set of problems, you're going to develop expertise that you can't develop if you're in the private sector and you only have a couple of cases here and there of this kind of problem, right?
Right.
Because you're not, yeah.
So are they making progress in helping people with PTSD?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean, they have a National Center for PTSD that not only helps veterans but helps all kinds of people. They're called in. They were called in with the World Trade Center. They're called in. They were called in with the Oklahoma bombing. I mean, the thing about the VHA is it's a national system. It's publicly funded. So things are free. They're not proprietary. They develop something and they're not trying to make money off of it. So we all benefit from it, and they don't keep it a secret.
From what I've read in your book, it sounds like one of the other things that make things difficult for the VHA in treating veterans is that a lot of soldiers are discouraged from seeking treatment for anything while they're in the service. And so maybe conditions build up.
That is a really serious problem. And that was something I was really, not surprised, but it was illuminating to discover that, I mean, you can imagine that, you know, there's a lot of sort of macho, tough guy, tough woman stuff going on in the military. And, you know, you're a soldier, suck it up, or you're a corpsman or whatever. And so there's a lot of discouraging people from going to the medic, going to the doctor, particularly around mental health conditions. The Army says it's getting better at this. I'm not so sure how much better it's getting. And, you know, people are afraid that if they admit that they have PTSD, they're going to get, they'll get medically discharged or removed or whatever. And they also don't know that in order to get compensation and service connection, you have to have a paper trail. So the thing I think it's important for people to know, Monica and Caroline, is that that you can't get healthcare from the VHA unless you have a service-connected condition, you know, so something that was, like, acquired or exacerbated by military service, or you have, and or you have low income. So if you can't prove, if you don't have a paper trail, that, you know, the knee problems you have are a result of jumping out of airplanes with parachutes and, you know, landing on the ground kind of hard, you will have trouble getting compensated or service connected for that illness. And personally, I feel like we have enough money in this country to care for every single veteran served in the military.
And it's not like they got paid that much while they were serving.
Yeah, it's not like they got, you know, they're not like hedge fund.
Yeah.
You know, hedge fund guys, they didn't get like $100 million bonuses every year. And we have plenty of money to take care of these people. And, you know, also if we had a national healthcare system, we, and the VA was part of that, we will also be taking care of every veteran, and we should also be taking care of veterans' families because, you know, if somebody has serious PTSD, this is becoming a big family problem, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, but there's a lot of, you know, I'm not going to tell, I can tough it out. I mean, I interviewed veterans who'd been suffering, it's just tragic, who have been suffering from PTSD since the Korean War.
Oh,
or
gosh.
Since the Vietnam War, and never went and gotten help. And it is just tragic, and that's because of this attitude of, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, I'm just like this, this is just normal, just suck it up, just get on with your life. And it stops people from getting help. It also stop, you know, that when people are discharged from the service, particularly if they've been in combat roles, they like want to get home right away, and they're asked if they have a problem, and people have told me that they just lie because they don't want to be put on a medical hold for 3 months. They want out.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
but,
I can understand
that. But then
that
prevents them from possibly getting care later.
Absolutely.
And they may
but
not be
aware. But if we had a no-fault, you know, a kind of no-fault system, no questions asked.
Yeah.
I mean, we sort of have that with Agent Orange now, that there's a whole bunch of conditions related to Agent Orange, the dioxin that was used in Vietnam, and you're presumed to have, if you were a boots on the ground in Vietnam and you get diabetes, it's or a number of other conditions, it's presumed to be connected to Agent Orange. Military sexual trauma is another thing that you don't have to prove. But, you know, if you have bad knees and you were parachuting down from the skies, you know, I know veterans who were refused compensation, and I've seen their exam reports, and it'll say, you know, it has to have been that, but there's no record because he didn't go to the doctor.
Oh, brother.
And he's refused compensation, and that's unacceptable. You know, and that's Congress that does that by forcing veterans to prove it.
Now, if somebody does have a service-connected injury, are they then eligible for treatment for other conditions as well?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. But there's ridiculous, you know, eligibility requirements that Congress has imposed that, you know, you have 10% service connection for this and 70% for that. And it's just, in my view, ridiculous. You know, everybody should be treated.
And think how much time and energy is wasted on actually calculating that, and how much money we would save by not having to deal with making
absolutely
those decisions.
Yeah, and you know, if you have 20 million veterans now, the people who aren't eligible get health insurance somewhere else, or, you know, they're healthier and wealthier, and so they're less sick. And because the eligibility requirements mean that the VHA takes care of the sickest, oldest, and poorest people, so that means that they're sicker. They have more acute problems, or more acute and chronic problems. So if you would, I don't know if anybody's ever costed this out, but if you took all the veterans in, it's not like it would be double the, you know, double or triple the amount that we're spending now on 9 million because those people are healthier and wealthier.
Mm. Very good point. Very good point. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Suzanne Gordon, author of Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans. There's so much more I want to talk about, but I want to give you a chance to read a little from the book so that our listeners can get a feel for the book itself.
Oh, sure. So I didn't exactly time it, but I have two little sections I'd like to read.
Great.
One is from a chapter called Those Who Have Borne the Battle, the VHA's Patient Population, and it's a little profile of it's Fred, a veteran I named Fred Fuller, but that's not his real name. Fred Fuller's house seems as remote as you can get if you live in the middle of the city. The last on the road, it hugs the edge of the mountain. This way, he tells me, he can patrol the perimeter and prevent any stealth attacks. Fuller, a burly 40-year-old with curly black hair and several days' worth of black stubble flecked with gray, apologizes for the fact that we can't park in a driveway cluttered with tools, sawhorses, and other construction equipment. I'm building myself a shop, he says. It's driving my wife crazy. When we go inside and sit down at the kitchen table, he gives me his military history. The son of a Vietnam veteran, Fred joined the Army when he was 18 because, he says, I just wanted to fight. He ended up defusing mine in the DMZ in Korea. Korea, he acknowledges now, was not a great place to be when you were a 19-year-old kid prone to drinking, partying, and run after girls. From South Korea, Russia, New Zealand, you name it, Korea had all of them, he says. Fuller, when he left the Army, he had knee, foot, and shoulder trouble from carrying around a 100-pound pack day in and day out. Fuller tells me that, like other soldiers, he was discouraged from going to the medic or doctor for any, quote, owie, as he dubs injuries. Complain about something, even something serious, and they had a name for you. In addition to wuss, pussy, or it was sick, call ranger, or just plain malingerer. When he came back home, he signed up for the GI Bill and went to community college. While in school, he met a National Guard recruiter who, as he puts it, waved a magic wand. He told Fuller that if he signed up for the Hawaii National Guard, he wouldn't have to spend his GI Bill money on education, but could use it for getting a mortgage and taking care of his family. This was too good a deal to pass up. So, he continues, for the 8 years I owed them, I went to doing part-time 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, what I was paid to do in the Army. He finished college, and then he got a phone call informing him about orders for Iraq. He couldn't believe it and hung up. They called back, dude, you need to come down to the unit. We're going to Iraq. Fuller spent the next 22 months working in force protection in Iraq. We were the guys to prevent bad stuff from happening, barriers, counterblast barriers, stopping suicide bombers from getting in. When he left the military and returned to his family, he got a job in the county sheriff's department. He had all the aches and pains he had acquired during his first stint in the military, plus some new problems. He was having nightmares, drinking himself to sleep, and constantly irritable. I was a total cockhead, Fuller admits. I was angry, bitter, violent. Being in the sheriff's department, well, you know, says, trailing off, inviting me to fill in the blank. Finally, his wife had enough and kicked him out of his house. Fuller had lost enough over the years. He did not want to lose his family. So he checked himself into Dr. Kenneth Hurst's Post-Traumatic Stress Recovery Rehabilitation Program at the Honolulu VA. When Fuller entered the six-week residential program, Hirsch asked him what his goals were. That was simple, Fuller says. I told him I just wanted to save my family. Hirsch said, okay, we can help you do that, but you in turn have to do two things. One, Fuller says, was come to Jesus. By that he did not mean getting religion, but rather admitting there was something wrong. For Fuller, that would not be easy. Honestly, he says now, I thought I was perfectly sane and the rest of them were crazy. Iraq just totally cemented in me my ideals of what the world should be versus what it is. That ended up being my issue with my wife and kids. The second thing Hirsch wanted the veteran to do, Fuller reports, was, quote, use the tools we give you. If you use the tools properly, we can't guarantee that your wife won't leave you, but we can guarantee it will be a little bit better. He agreed, and the results were dramatic. The VHA helped me save my wife and kids, he says. They gave me the one thing I needed more than anything else, that 4 seconds to think before I act. This guy just cut me off in traffic because he's a dumbass. This person is just some idiot and a lowrider who's just blasting his music 75 decibels too loud. Instead of taking them on, Fuller says, he fought the impulse successfully. But 12 months later, Fuller explains, my wife had gotten tired of my ass and drove me back to the VHA and said, throw him back into PRP, the post-traumatic stress rehab program. Dr. Hirsch said, yeah, we got a bed for him. When he left the program the second time, Fuller realized that he could not move forward if he remained in law enforcement. I don't like gray areas, he confesses. I'm in for a penny, I'm in for a pound. What that means is I can play cop or I can play family man. If I'm going to be a cop, I'm going to be the best damn cop this place has ever seen. That involved, he says, fighting and being angry and irritable, all the behaviors he was trying to overcome. The VA provided him with $25,000 worth of vocational rehabilitation services, and he has gone into construction work. He continues to get treatment for his ongoing emotional problems and for his knees, feet, neck, and shoulders. He volunteers in his children's school every day, he tells me. That way, I have a reason to go in there and make sure they're safe. After his stint in the military, safety is not something Fred Fuller will ever take for granted again.
Wow.
You
talked to so many veterans that had stories similar to that, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just astonishing. And there's so many stories that didn't make it into the book because, I just have all these interviews, poignant interviews. And you know, not every veteran has mental health problems, of course, but, you know, there's an idea that you shouldn't talk about veterans with mental health problems because that's going to give people the idea that, you know, all veterans are crazy. But the reality is that most Americans have mental health problems. You know, I mean, do you know anybody who comes from a functional family? I mean, maybe you and your daughter do, but
yeah,
and
we're
I hope
pretty
me
good.
And my daughters do. I know me and my mother didn't, you know, but hopefully I've learned. But, you know, we all have problems. I mean, the reality is that if you have veterans who have mental health problems, they get really good treatment. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying that people have these problems. I mean, war is hell, and you don't even have to go to war to have mental health problems because military training is kind of brutal. There's people who've never left the continental U.S. who've had problems. But, you know, we have to admit that there is a subset of veterans who have really serious behavioral health issues and mental health problems. And the VHA, I mean, so many programs in the VHA deal with that.
Well, honestly, you'd almost have to wonder about somebody who was in combat who didn't have mental health issues.
Well, yeah, you said it. I worry about the people. I'm not so worried about the 30% of PTSD. I'm worried about the 70% who think it's okay. But you know, the thing is, I mean, one of the things I think that people have to understand, too, is that veterans can be very cranky and irritable and, you know, they feel often they've been let down by society. There's a very small subset that are dangerous, and the VHA has a program for what they call disruptive behavior that I describe in the book. And we had an instance of a terrible thing that happened out here. It wasn't in what was connected to the VA, but there was a wonderful program called the Pathway Home. That's a private, non-for-profit that it was the subject of the movie and book, Thank You for Your Service. And they had rented space in the California Veterans Home in Yountville in Napa Valley. And they had a very seriously mentally ill veteran who should have never been taken into the Army and trained to use weapons. And they had to discharge him from the program, and he ended up coming in and taking a bunch of people hostage and killing the three women who directed the program, one of whom was a VA employee who was 32 and 26 months pregnant, and then he killed himself. And the Pathway Home program had to close. If something like that happens in the VA, which it does, they can't close the largest national system in the country. And Pathway Home now is working to continue its amazing legacy of care by supporting a program in the Martinez, California VA for difficult-to-treat Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And they've really created a model of a public-private partnership that is very different from the kind of model the Trump administration is pursuing, which is essentially outsourcing care to private sector providers who really aren't equipped to take care of veterans, some of whom are recommending very dubious mental health treatments that are untested and unproven, but will enrich their coffers, even if they harm veterans. And Pathway mm-hmm. Home is a really important example of what we can achieve if groups really try to help support the VA rather than dismantle it, which is what we're seeing in Congress. We're seeing efforts to dismantle the VA, not to strengthen and improve it and make it the best it can be.
The whole idea of just outsourcing it to private just doesn't make any sense for all the reasons that you outline in the book. One of the things that I wonder about is, the number of doctors and clinicians who work for the VA, they're all paid a salary.
Right.
They probably aren't making as much as they might make if they were in private practice. What motivates them to choose this career path?
Thank you for asking that. So the VA has something like 300,000 employees. A third of them are veterans. Most veteran employees are not doctors and nurses, although psychologists and so forth, although some are. They're motivated to serve veterans. They're motivated by teamwork, by this community of caring that I describe in the book, by this community of learning, by not being hassled about having to call an insurance company and think about money, by being able to offer state-of-the-art treatments and do state-of-the-art research and really care for people without financial considerations getting in the way. And they are so mission-driven, you know. I mean, obviously there's people who get up on the wrong side of the bed on the day. There's people who maybe should find a career somewhere else. But the majority of people I encountered were really devoted to taking care of veterans, and they know what they're doing. And in the private sector, we have study after study saying that people don't know about military culture. They don't know about veteran-specific problems. I mean, RAND Corporation, an independent group, studied providers in New York State, and that's a state with the fifth largest veteran population. They found that only 2% of providers met their criteria for readiness to serve veterans. And they just, you know, most private practices, they don't ask people even if they served in the military.
Well, how is it that the VA has gotten such a bad reputation? I don't understand. I mean,
well,
all
the
you
Koch
hear...
brothers, the conservative, I mean, they're not even conservative, the ultra-radical libertarian Koch brothers have spent millions of dollars to trash the VA. And they've put out a narrative of the VA is broken that contradicts all the facts. And tragically, even the mainstream media has promoted that narrative. And, you know, I wish your listeners would call their congresspeople and, you know, whether they're veterans or not, or call the media and say, you know, why aren't you reporting on the good things the VA does, you know? Why aren't you funding and staffing the VA? Why aren't providers in the VA being offered market rate salaries? The VA is in many places not allowed to offer market rate salaries because they don't want it to compete with the private sector, because Congress knows that if the VA were to be really allowed to compete with the private sector, a government-run program would win. It wins in the studies, and it would win, you know, in people would flock to work at the VA because, you know, it's, you don't have to call your insurance company's Mother May I line every time you want to write a prescription or recommend a treatment.
Well, it makes sense if you take the profit motive out of delivering health care that it's going to be done more efficiently and effectively.
Yeah, I mean, we spend $1 out of $7 in America on unnecessary futile treatment. There's no incentive in the VA, which isn't a fee-for-service system, to do that. I mean, we spend, I don't know, a staggering proportion of every healthcare dollar on administration and marketing. You know, these hospitals, they complain about bonuses in the VA. I mean, they often, you know, people will get a performance bonus of maybe $5,000, $2,000 as a kind of retention effort because they aren't offered market rate salaries. They complain about these bonuses, these pathetic itsy-bitsy bonuses, whereas in the private sector, I mean, at the Cleveland Clinic, Toby Cosgrove, who was the CEO at this time, he earned almost $500,000 salary increases every year between 2010 and 2013 when his hospital system was being threatened with suspension from the Medicare program for serious patient safety violations. So one standard is applied to private sector care and another to the VA.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
So are you like the lone warrior out there fighting for the VA?
Not at all. I mean, there's some wonderful, I mean, Philip Longman at the Washington Monthly, who is a dear colleague and friend, wrote a wonderful book called Best Care Anywhere. I work with a group called the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute. There's a young journalist called Jasper Craven. Isaac Armsdorf has written amazing stuff on the VA. But, you know, there's a handful of us that really want to do balanced, accurate journalism. I've done work for the Center for Investigative Reporting on this. That should get a shout out. The American Legion commissioned Philip Longman and I to do a piece on the VA called A System Worth Saving, but there's just not enough voices. And the American Federation of Government Employees, the union that represents VA employees, has been fighting privatization. But I think we need, you know, more voices. I mean, Veterans for Peace is a great group that's been fighting privatization, and they have an entire Stop the VA Privatization campaign. But, you know, I think people who are more liberal and progressive need to stop drinking the purple Kool-Aid about that the media is serving up. And people, I'm always shocked when my friends who are more liberal and progressive, I say I'm writing about the VA, and they say, oh my God, you must be writing an expose. And I said, yeah, I'm writing an expose about how great it is.
and you've actually, you've been on the ground. You've been in these hospitals, in these clinics, talking to the patients.
Well, I've sat there with them. I mean, I think I have a pretty good Geiger counter for, how do we say it, for
BS?
Yes, you said it. Okay. And yeah. I mean, I'm not going to talk to VA providers who tell me we're great and then believe it, you know. And I've seen, by the way, I've seen some VA providers who aren't great, who should do something else, you know. Very few, but the odd one. But what I, you know, I said, you know, I can't just take your word for it. I have to talk to veterans, and I want to see it. I want to see it in action. And I've sat in primary care exam rooms, and I've sat in mental health visits and, you know, mindfulness training, and I've seen it, and it is amazing.
Well, Suzanne, I mean, we're out of time, unfortunately, and we never even got to talk about the actual writing of the book, which is usually what we like to talk about at least part of the way, but this was such an important topic, and you have so much information to share, and we want to thank you so much for being with us today.
And I thank you for having me.
And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Well, yeah, I do. It's the reality is that in war, nobody wins.
Thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.